From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams. And it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, tech in the classroom. In many colleges and universities, gone are the days of the iconic blackboard and chalk. In its place, a software program. NPR's Joshua Brockman introduces us to a system that's rewriting how professors teach and interact with their students.
The sound of chalk on a blackboard is something you rarely hear on many campuses these days. That's because more and more professors use technology to distribute course materials, issue grades, and enhance communication with students.
I'll say it again. The line marked MUNNA is testing the null hypothesis.
Philip Wirtz, a professor at the George Washington University, is presenting some complicated material during his statistics class. To help students follow along, he uses a software program called Blackboard to share slides.
It's really just a mechanism for coordinating a lot of the what would otherwise be paper in the course.
But it's not just about saving trees.
It's a one-stop shop where students can come and get absolutely any access to me, any access to the teaching assistants.
Colleges and universities are experimenting with different ways to connect students and teachers. More than 200 institutions, including Stanford and the University of Michigan, are using open-source software created by Sakai or Moodle. These classroom management systems are becoming increasingly popular because they allow schools to adapt the software to meet their needs. Blackboard, however, is the largest commercial player in the higher education market. The company has over 2,000 clients in the U.S. As students pack up their laptops, MBA candidate Brianna Lux says this software is making life easier for busy students because they can listen to classes on demand.
And it's really nice. He has all the lectures posted through. You can access iTunes U. So if ever you're doing your lab homework and what did he say in class? So you can go back, you can access it that way. And it's nice just to have everything in one place.
Eric Klopfer runs the teacher education program at MIT. He says the software can also make the classroom experience more interactive.
That potentially changes fundamentally what's going on inside the university classroom, where instead of listening to the lecture and taking notes, maybe you listen to the lecture from your dorm room, and then you actually use the class time to do other things.
And what would some of those other things be?
They could be hands-on activities, they could be labs, they could be discussions with other students.
Even though Blackboard continues to grow through acquisitions, Klopfer says the company could face competition from Google in the collegiate market. That's if the focus of learning management systems shifts because of demand for more online collaboration.
If that transition happens, a company like Google stands to gain from that because they have a lot of those collaborative tools.
Blackboard CEO Michael Chasen says his company has plans to expand into the elementary and secondary school market. Chasen says there's a lot of growth potential there, but some aggravating downsides too.
Schools are making an active effort to keep the parents more involved by using the Blackboard software. The students have expressed concerns that now their parents know too much. They know all the homework that's due. They know how they're doing in class. And we've somehow interfered with their social lives within the high school.
He's even received his fair share of angry letters and email from students upset about how they were able to continue to do schoolwork despite last month's blizzards. The technology, though, melted the snow days away. Joshua Brockman, NPR News.
General Motors is taking a second shot at the electric car. The company is producing a small number of Chevy Volts to check for quality and reliability. They'll go on sale here in California later this year. As Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports, the automaker is trying to win back customers who a decade ago bought GM's first electric car, the one that was canceled.
Chris Trexler is visiting an old friend at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles.
Oh, gosh.
Here, sitting in a place of honor in the museum's electric car exhibit, is the very EV1 that Trexler leased from GM in the late 1990s. The car is unlocked, so he gets in.
Wow, this brings back some serious memories here. This is just amazing to see this car again.
GM made 500 of the all-electric two-seaters in a test program to see if they were viable in the marketplace at the time. Trexler is a car buff. He says at first he wanted one because it was the latest, hottest thing. But owning an electric car made him a convert.
It really was the most reliable car I've ever driven. It's just a car that I took home, plugged in at night, got up the next morning. It was like having a gasoline station in the garage.
The car was perfect for Trexler, but it had lots of limitations. It was smaller than your average sports car. It looked like something out of the Jetsons, and you could only drive it for about 70 miles before the battery ran out of juice.
Range anxiety was a big issue.
That's GM's Andrew Farah. He worked on the EV1 program and now is head of engineering for the Volt. He says it was hard to calculate how far you could drive that little car. In fact, he got stranded on his way home from work one day. Engineers designed the Volt to correct for this and other shortcomings. So the Volt has a gasoline generator to recharge the battery on longer trips.
You get all the benefits of a pure battery electric vehicle with none of the detriments, and then you can continue to drive hundreds of miles on longer trips burning fuel and do it as efficiently as the hybrids do.
Farah says the gas generator gives the Volt a big advantage over an all-electric car like Nissan's Leaf, which will also be launched this year. The Leaf will have about the same range as the EV1. The Volt will be more expensive. Even after tax rebates, it's likely to cost more than $30,000. But Farah says a Volt will still be cheaper than buying a Leaf for the daily commute plus another car for longer trips.
What's the cheapest possible car I can buy? Add it in there, it's going to be more than the Volt.
So is it frustrating it took us 10 years to get back to where we started? Yeah, but I'm just glad we're here.
That's Chelsea Sexton. 10 years ago, she was in charge of marketing for the EV1. She left GM in a public huff after the company killed the program. Now she directs a nonprofit that supports the adoption of electric vehicles.
I joke a lot with some of the old EV1 guys that are now working on Volt. That, you know, it's almost like the band's getting back together, but now we finally have an audience.
GM hopes it can sell up to 60,000 Volts a year. That's a huge number compared to its hopes for the EV1. The company isn't taking a single potential customer for granted. GM wants to sell Volts to its former EV1 customers, too. And this time, GM plans to keep the cars on the road instead of in a museum. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
One of the most famous names in photography is trying for a comeback. Polaroid, the company that popularized instant photography, has struggled in recent years. It even announced it would stop making its famous instant film. But starting today, an upstart company is selling Polaroid-compatible film, and Polaroid is selling a new image. NPR's Barry Gordimer reports.
That's Lady Gaga, singer, fashion maven, and marketing dynamo. Her new music video for the song Telephone is chock full of strategically placed products, and Polaroid is among the most visible. Lady Gaga isn't just a Polaroid fan. This year she signed a deal to become a creative director. Reportedly, she also has an equity share in the company. It's a good deal for both sides. Gaga might get some money, and Polaroid gets a big boost in its effort to be cool again. In the 1960s and 70s, Polaroid was the height of cool. It was the Apple of its day. A creative innovator whose founder, Edwin Land, is often compared to Apple's CEO, Steve Jobs.
When people talk about him, they use words like dazzling or fascinating, not so much his personality as his knowledge and his genius that kind of overwhelmed you.
That's David Bushman of the Paley Center for Media in New York. He says when Land debuted his first instant camera in 1948, people thought it was a miracle.
It completely changed the relationship between people and photography and cameras. And the impact of something like that, I think it's difficult to understand today.
Polaroid was a household name, but then digital cameras got big, and who needed instant film when you had digital? Polaroid came up with its own digital camera, but it wasn't very good, says Mark McCluskey, a senior editor at Wired magazine.
When you think about digital cameras, you think about Canon and Nikon, and then you think about Sony and Panasonic and Kodak. Polaroid sort of never enters the conversation. They aren't a player.
Polaroid's reputation shriveled. In 2001, the company went bankrupt. Then it was bought by a man who later would be convicted of running a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme. The biggest blow came in 2008, when Polaroid announced it would stop making its iconic instant film. The company went bankrupt again. By then, Polaroid was little more than a name. But in business, names have value.
Polaroid is a global brand that has 100% recognition against the likes of companies like McDonald's, Nike, Disney.
That's Scott Hardy, the president of PLRIP, the company that bought the Polaroid name and licenses it to manufacturers. But instant film was not dead yet. A group of Polaroid fans and ex-employees formed a company called The Impossible Project. They took over an old Polaroid factory in the Netherlands and started making instant film again, using a different process, though, because the original Polaroid chemicals were no longer available. Andre Boseman headed up the project.
I'm sure if you would make a phone call with some of the old research people from Polaroid, they would assure you that we were mad.
It was an incredible risk, but late last year, the Impossible Project struck a licensing deal with PLRIP. New black and white film goes on sale today. Color is coming soon. Boseman says it's clearer and crisper than the original film, but that may not be what Polaroid enthusiasts want. Photo historian Claude Cookman describes the appeal of the original film.
The colors feel quite different. They are not crisp and clear, and has a certain retro feel to it in terms of its color and its size, and I think this is a really important dimension of it.
And here again is David Bushman of the Paley Center.
Today, when we're used to looking at, you know, HDTV and digital photography and so on, there's something very quaint and very sort of, I don't know what the comparable word to otherworldly is, but it has a very nostalgic value to it for that reason.
Polaroid's Scott Hardy says there is a market for instant film, even if it's a small one. And the company's not banking on film alone. It also sells other products, including digital cameras, one with a built-in instant printer. But technology journalist Mark McCluskey is skeptical that Polaroid will become a household name again.
It seems unlikely to me that Polaroid's going to regain that status in the marketplace. You know, stranger things have certainly happened in this world, but they have a long road ahead of them.
Whatever happens with Polaroid, at least it's got Lady Gaga along for the ride. Barry Gordimer, NPR News, Washington.
You can read about how a team of Dutch scientists reinvented Polaroid's photographic process and see photos from the Impossible Project at our website, npr.org.
Google is feeling the wrath of China. The company's other business deals in China are also coming under pressure 2 days after Google moved its search engine to Hong Kong. And a prominent Chinese scholar is accusing Google of being part of a deliberate American strategy to undermine the country. For the latest, we're joined from Shanghai by our correspondent, Louisa Lim. Hello.
Hi, Renee.
Tell us more about the reaction to Google's move, you know, the reaction on the ground there in China.
Well, Renee, it's interesting. We're seeing a couple of different things happening at the same time. There is this nationalistic backlash against Google. One example is that scholar that you mentioned that works for China's State Council. And we're also seeing online some other nationalistic bloggers who are basically saying good riddance to Google. The typical kind of comment that they're making is that Google's insulted China and perhaps was sent by the US to damage the unity of the Chinese people. So there is some vocal anti-Google feeling. But at the same time, if you look at Google's own figures, there are signs that after Google transferred its search engine to Hong Kong, its share of the search market in China actually increased. On Monday, for a while, it actually got more traffic than the market leader Baidu, so it became the number one search engine in China just for a bit. Now, that could be curiosity as people try it to see what difference it makes, but it does indicate that user figures have been up a little bit the last couple of days.
And tell us about Google's Chinese partners. I mean, are they sticking with Google or beginning to abandon the company?
There are signs that some of them are beginning to abandon it. China's second largest mobile phone carrier, Unicom, says it's removing Google Search from its cell phones. And its president told reporters that it would only work with companies that abide by Chinese law. And we've also seen one very popular Chinese portal called Tianya.cn. That's also taking control over some of its social networking services that it had operated together with Google. So some are cutting loose, but others are staying loyal. And we spoke to the CEO of a music download service called Top100.cn, and he told us he would stay with Google, and he was expecting even closer cooperation with Google in the days to come.
And, of course, Google has a number of other services that it offers there in China. What about them?
So far, we've not seen any further blocking of Google services, but that's what people are looking for next, to see if things like Google Maps or Gmail in China get blocked. So far, they're working fine, but I might add that Gmail has even introduced a new service which detects suspicious activity on your Gmail account. And on Twitter here, people are saying it's a service to see whether the Chinese government is reading your Gmail.
So what about other foreign companies? Any up to now following Google's lead out of China?
Well, yes, we have seen the first company to announce its departure publicly since Google left, and that's GoDaddy, the world's biggest domain name company. And they blamed a new Chinese government regulations. But the fact is, actually, GoDaddy's China business is pretty small. It registered just 27,000.cn domain names last year. That's less than 1% of its whole business. So in a way, it's quite similar to Google, whose China business only accounted for 2% of its global income. So it too is making a stand against censorship without really damaging its bottom lines.
Louisa, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's NPR's Louisa Lim in Shanghai, bringing us up to date on Google in China.
Here's a question for the leaders of Haiti and the international effort to rebuild it after the earthquake. What's not worth rebuilding? And here's an answer from John Stanton, a U.S. wireless executive. Don't bother rebuilding the damaged copper wire communications network. Go entirely wireless. Mr. Stanton's company, Trilogy, owns Haiti's second biggest cell phone company, Voila, and he joins us from Seattle. Mr. Stanton, what would Haiti gain by going all wireless and skipping the copper altogether?
In a country like Haiti, where security has always been an issue, the wired network has had great challenges. It's very difficult, in part because copper is actually stolen often. By building an entirely wire-free system to replace the old wired network that was there, you are able to build it for less cost, you're able to maintain it at a lower cost, and you're able to do it much more quickly.
As I understand that there are three competitive cell phone companies in Haiti and a 30% penetration of the market. That means most Haitians don't have a cell phone. Would abandoning the copper infrastructure mean never again an old-fashioned public telephone, no common telephone anywhere?
Well, before the quake, Haiti, with a population of 10 million people, had about 10,000 wired phones. When you think about that, it really wasn't an essential part of communications for the individual. Most of those lines were business lines.
How much does a cell phone call cost in Haiti, or how much does a month of service cost in Haiti?
Well, there is no such thing as monthly service in Haiti for any of the carriers. It's 100% prepaid. The prices vary depending on how big of a charge card you take, but our average revenue in Haiti is about 6 cents a minute.
6 cents a minute. And people buy cards for their phones, is what you're saying, as they do in much of the world. At that rate, frankly, is there that much of a market in Haiti beyond 30%? We're talking about a few minutes on the phone starting to equal a couple of hours' labor.
It's actually not quite that bad, but the minimum wage is now $5 a day in Haiti, which is terribly low. But remember, a significant part of the economy in Haiti is actually money being sent by family from the United States, from the Dominican Republic, back to Haiti. And those calls are very important.
One argument that I read that was critical of the idea of becoming copper-free is that fiber optics will be necessary, and if you don't maintain anything, Haiti won't be there. That may seem like a very luxurious concern for the Haitians at this moment, but do you really believe that if you skipped copper infrastructure today, that would be the end for all landline service, for data transmission, or any other purpose?
Well, none of the technologies that you described exist in Haiti today, and it's not clear that the government-owned telephone company that was able to sell between 10 and 11,000 wired phones over a 50-year period is an entity that was going to roll that out.
Your company owns Voila, a cell phone company in Haiti. How would you describe your company's own rebuilding efforts in Haiti since the quake?
Well, in terms of our people, that's the real tragedy. We think about three quarters of our staff lost either a spouse, parent, child, or another close relative in the quake. So it's hard to fathom in a relatively small country, virtually everyone was directly affected by the quake.
Well, Mr. Stanton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That's John Stanton of Trilogy. That's a company which owns Haiti's second largest cell phone company, Voila, talking about his proposal for Haiti to go completely wireless.
The dot-com bubble has long since burst, but one Silicon Valley perk is alive and well. Free lunch. Rory Gallagher takes us behind the scenes of one well-known company's kitchen.
Thank you, Swash.
One of the most popular cooks in Silicon Valley is Facebook's executive chef and self-designated culinary overlord, Joseph Desimone. His bustling kitchen serves 1,300 lunches a day, more than some restaurants serve over the course of a week.
Chicken. We got 12 lasagnas in house all day.
Okay. Then we go to Scampi. Okay.
Desimone was on track for a successful career in San Francisco's competitive restaurant world, but then Google came calling. At first, he wouldn't even consider a job as a corporate chef. To him, that was the easy way out, with weekends off, repeating menus, and canned ingredients. But he changed his mind in 2003.
And when I went to Google, it was nothing like that. It was completely the opposite. It was all free range. It was all organic. It was everything that the restaurant I was working at couldn't afford to be.
5 years later, he started the Facebook culinary program from scratch.
We do a brand new menu every single day, every single meal period, from a different region of the world, which, you know, I don't know any restaurant that does that.
The fare ranges from Italian to Korean to Scandinavian to Northern Indian. He says that variety is essential for Facebook employees.
Changing the menu and being so diverse with it's great because we got people here from all over the world, you know, and I'm sure a lot of them are homesick. They're from Sweden, he's from India, but what I can do is bring a little slice of what you're used to here.
Facebook employees Sarah Brooks and Joanna Lee are chowing down on wasabi mashed potatoes and tofu steak today.
I've always found something that I can eat every day really safely, and it makes me really happy.
It also makes for a healthier environment, so, you know, you have healthy options in the workplace instead of, you know, grabbing a bag of chips or grabbing fast food.
But health and happiness are not the only things high-tech companies care about when they start an in-house meal program. It also helps with looking for new talent, as Lee has seen firsthand.
I definitely think it's a perk that's difficult to compete with and almost like a standard now in Silicon Valley.
You know, Google offered food, all of a sudden they were the engineering mecca. Facebook offered food, all of a sudden, same thing. You know, they become the engineering mecca. There's a reason for that. It's a great recruiting tool.
And with breakfast, lunch, and dinner offered, in addition to perks like free dry cleaning, free transportation, and even free gyms at some companies, it's easier to get employees to put in the long hours demanded by the high-tech industry. For NPR News, I'm Rory Gallagher in Palo Alto, California.
This is NPR News.